Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at MormonStories.org. Hello and welcome to another edition of Mormon Stories Podcast. I'm your host, John DeLynn, and I'm very excited to have with us today Dr. James Nagel. Hi, James.
Hello. Great to be here.
How you doing?
Very good.
Good. Quick introduction. I've known about James and his work for a long time, but just to keep it short, James has done a lot of study on the psychology of religion. And if I could just give a background for why I thought this particular interview would be interesting. Even though James has a PhD in electrical engineering, he really has done a lot of cool work on understanding why people believe things, and specifically believe things about religion. And, you know, there's really one main purpose to all this as far as I'm concerned, and that's that regardless of where you live, and we'll get into this later, regardless of what you believe, if you're Mormon, if you're Hindu, if you're Buddhist, if you're Catholic, even if you're atheist, you've got to be curious about what it is that enables people to believe what they believe. And I'm sure even the most devout Mormon would wonder why it is that a Catholic would say, for example, that they feel inspired to follow Catholicism, or a Muslim might feel inspired to do the same. And how do we make sense of all that, given that whatever religion we happen to claim to believe in, if we still believe in a religion, we consider our experiences to be authentic, and chances are our doctrine sort of is somewhat mutually exclusive from the truthfulness of other churches. And so we have to sort of reconcile that different people feel inspired or called to believe things that can't mutually be true. And that's kind of what this discussion is about today. It's about, you know, what's the psychology behind belief in religion? How could we understand it better based on, you know, what scientists and psychologists, you know, the research that they've done? And that's kind of what James is going to be talking about with us today. Does that sound like an okay introduction, James?
Yes, that's a very good description of what we'll be doing.
All right. And it's going to be a multi-part series. And I think the most important part I want to mention is that James has put together some really cool PowerPoint slides. So this podcast is going to be released both as audio format, traditionally on the Mormon Stories feed, but it's also going to be released on YouTube, so you can go and check out the slides. We'll probably provide the slides as well, just as downloads. But I really recommend, if you can, that you check out the slides to this presentation, because the visuals, in some instances, are almost crucial to understand the concepts and the studies that we're going to discuss. Although, James, we've done a lot to try and simplify that, right?
Yeah, so we're going to do our best to try and make it audio friendly, even though there are a bunch of pictures to go along with our discussion.
Yeah. All right, well, let's dig in. Just tell us a little bit about yourself, James.
So, I guess we'll just skip ahead to slide number two then.
Yeah.
We'll talk about the overview. You've more or less discussed what we'll be doing for our discussion here. A little bit of background on me, and then a discussion on social psychology and how I got involved in this study. And then we're going to talk a little bit more about this idea of where religions come from and how they grow and evolve, and just really a nice scientific explanation for their interactions.
Okay.
So slide number three now, this is what you just asked about me. What's my background and where am I from? Like you said, I have my official academic background is actually electrical engineering. And so that's kind of interesting how I suddenly got this sidebar project getting involved in social psychology, and we'll really explore that as we move along. So it's kind of interesting that my real background is electromagnetics, things like antennas and propagation. I have a lot of research in solar cells and light-emitting diodes. And
fun.
So it's interesting how there's just this huge disparity between what I do professionally and what I've done in this psychology realm here. But, you know, something to emphasize is, you know, I got my bachelor's degree and master's degree from BYU. And then I worked in industry for a while before coming to the University of Utah, where I got my PhD. So, you know, something I'd like to sort of stress is, you know, my official study in social psychology is a very sort of amateur level. Something I stumbled into and started putting together and just reading the college level books and digging through the actual original research papers that people publish throughout the years. And it's just really fascinating stuff, this great journey of self-discovery, learning how people think and how they organize information in their lives. And so something to just sort of emphasize is it's all just kind of science in the end. I've been through the scientific process, so I'm pretty well trained in telling the difference between good science and bad science. So what I want people to try and remember through this discussion is don't really take my word for it. This is sort of an amateur passion of mine, not a professional. Don't treat me as an authoritative expert on this, although I'm sure a lot of authorities will agree with what I've been saying throughout this discussion. Because I'm really just going to base everything we say on the actual original experiments and just draw conclusions from the science itself.
Got it.
So this is kind of the classic
disclaimer.
Disclaimer, you know, why should I trust you? Well, don't. You shouldn't. You should trust the science.
Okay. Excellent.
So we'll go on to slide 4 here, a little more personal history about me. I was born in California and raised LDS. And I moved to Utah when I was 16. Just my parents divorced, and I came to Provo, Utah with my dad. And so that's actually a really interesting culture shock to be born in a place like the Bay Area. San Francisco Bay Area is a very culturally diverse place. And it's interesting, you know, being Mormon in a place where practically no one's even heard of what a Mormon is, and then to suddenly move to a world where everybody, 90% of the population around you, is LDS. So I think that really kind of influenced the way I perceive my relationship to the big picture of things. And we'll kind of see that crop up in some of our discussions as we look at where do we fit as Mormons in this grand scheme of world religions. So that's something I think really was helped by growing up in a very diverse culture where, you know, there really is no dominant religion or dominant ethnicity. It's just a very intermixed cultural
right.
and ethnic place.
Right.
So like I said, I went to BYU and got my degrees in electrical engineering. And part of that is, if you've ever been to BYU, they also require that you go through a formal religious study. So this is a nice sort of, I guess, contrast in my education is, you know, being very technical and scientific on at one moment and going to the sort of spiritual education in the other. So just kind of to emphasize that I've got a nice perspective on both of these worlds and how we're going to reconcile them together.
Got it.
So after that, I then came to University of Utah and did my PhD. You know, officially I did it in solar cells, but one of the great things about going to universities, you have a lot of access to academic journals.
Right.
So you can study just about anything you want in your spare time.
Yeah.
One of the best things I loved about living on campus there at the U is if you wanted to download a journal article, they actually had the internet rigged through our student housing such that it would automatically authenticate through the University of Utah library.
Yeah.
So you didn't have to worry about purchasing journals or articles. You could just get them on demand. It was great.
It's nice. I can attest to it. I got it myself.
So this final bullet point talks about just skeptical empirical rationalism. And these are important points that I want to just emphasize that are going to guide our discussion and the way we approach our knowledge about religion and belief and psychological mechanisms that intertwine them all. So the first principle I really want to emphasize is this idea of skepticism. And
now to an average Mormon, that term kind of denotes being negative, right?
Yeah, it actually has a very bad reputation, you know. Ooh, Mr. Skeptic's coming in to poop on all our beliefs and tell us we're all wrong about everything.
Right.
But really, at the end of the day, skepticism is just an idea that says, withhold your judgment until after you have some justification for it. You know, evidence first, belief second, not the other way around.
Got it.
And, you know, there's very practical reasons for viewing the world this way. And it's because if you believe first, then you're kind of a sucker. People will take advantage of you in a heartbeat if you just believe anything that comes along. So,
yeah, and even really, even believing Mormonism can can support skepticism, and the Book of Mormon says, you know, plant the seed, try it out, and see if it's true or not, and then pray about it, and if you get a witness. So, I mean, skepticism doesn't necessarily have to be contradictory to religion, right?
Exactly. And you know, we'll talk about that a little bit later on. That it's okay to believe crazy things. You just have to be very careful about what your justification is for that belief.
Okay.
So empiricism is just an idea that says, you know, physical evidence is the guiding light of what you use to justify your beliefs. You know, not what some bigwig authority says, not what your gut feeling tells you to do, and not what is written down in a book, you know.
Not even what James and John say in a podcast.
Not even what we say. You know, it's about the evidence itself that should determine your beliefs. And you know, I'm really emphasizing this because we're going to address these ideas later on as we look at some of these experiments and you know what a proper rational way is to approach a belief and how these experiments are rigged to just completely fool people by appealing to our sort of intuitive epistemology. And then, of course, rationalism is just an idea that it says – you know, use logic and reason to draw inferences about the world and make conclusions. Because we're going to do a lot of that as well in this discussion and really see how, you know, there's the correct way to draw inferences and then there's bad ways that can be taken advantage of.
Got it.
Okay. So that's really all I'm trying to do is set a tone for how we'll be approaching our discussion here.
Beautiful. All right. I'm good.
Okay. So next slide, slide number five. These are just a couple of books that really, I guess, sparked my interest in really understanding myself and psychology and how they relate to science and what science does to, I guess, correct our mistakes. And so these are two books written by Carl Sagan. One is called The Varieties of Scientific Experience and the other is called The Demon-Haunted World. And they're both just, I'm really plugging these because they sparked a lot of this discussion we're about to have. They set the seeds and built the foundation that got me interested in this psychological study. And in particular, they're very good at helping appreciate what science is all about. It's a series of tools that are designed to build knowledge. But part of the rules of science is figuring out how fallible you are as a person and then building into the method safeguards that keep you from falling into these pitfalls of your own fallibility. So these are just great books that help really set that tone and give you an appreciation for what science is and what it does. And for me, I'm just plugging them because they are very influential for me as well.
It's kind of about just how to seek for truth, right?
Yes, exactly. You know, it's about truth and what are the standards you use for determining truth in the end of the day. That's another really key thing that I don't think people really realize is, you know, what is a good standard of evidence and what is a bad one?
Right.
Okay. These are other things we'll really be addressing as we go along in our discussion.
Got it.
Okay. So slide number six now. This, I think, is really going to kind of set the tone. Says the religious stakes. And you see here on the left, you know, heaven is placid and fluffy and colorful and happy. And hell is, you know, a very miserable state of existence. Now, you know, Mormons don't exactly have this dichotomous view of heaven and hell. And, you know, most Christian theologies have various nuances. But more or less, this principle of being good and believing the right things will lead to some kind of eternal reward. And if you are bad and you make the wrong choices and believe the wrong things, then you know you're going to pay for it for eternity and be miserable and have no recourse, right? So these are ideas for me, you know, kind of as a young kid that really forced me to take my religion seriously. You know, I was kind of terrified of this idea of what if I'm wrong?
Right,
you know what I mean?
Right.
What if those Muslims, you know, the Shiite Muslims are actually the correct theology of how you're supposed to come close to God? You know, how would you know that? Because if you're wrong, you know, are you prepared to like stand before God someday and say, well, I picked this Mormon thing, and you know, he's going to say, no, sorry, that was wrong. You should have listened to my prophet Muhammad. Why didn't you? You had his book. You know, no excuses. Off the hell with you.
Right. Right. No virgins for you.
Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, conversely, you know, if you're a Muslim and it turns out, you know, the LDS faith is correct, you know, is he prepared to make that same choice? You know, what are you going to tell a Muslim to convince him that what he's doing is going to have everlasting consequences? You know, this is something that you know, in my brain as a kid really drove me to take this stuff seriously, because I was just so terrified about being wrong that I just started studying everything I could. So,
yeah, if I could just, I hope you're not going to talk about this later, but I remember us in some of our pre-discussions talking about what type of, you know, researcher and engineer and scientist would you want if you were going to be an astronaut flying up in a rocket, right? Would you want one who went purely by his feelings and trusted his first gut responses and built a rocket sort of based on faith and intuition and his first best guesses? Or would you want an engineer and a scientist that was willing to make lots of tests attempting to disprove something, and willing to accept, you know, changing his mind, re-engineering, and going through this crucial process of proving and disproving to get to the point where there was a high level of certainty that that was going to be a safe, successful journey? You know, which type of scientist would you, you know, researcher, engineer, would you want if you were that astronaut who was going to be flying the ship, right?
Yeah, that's a really great metaphor. And you know, I kind of had that same idea of, you know, when I'm dead, you know, am I going to rest comfortably knowing that I tried everything I could to figure out the truth of the matter? Or, you know, am I just going to be some sucker who falls victim to whatever crazy belief happened to come along first?
Because you happen to be born Mormon or Muslim or Hindu.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, right. So everyone who believes in heaven, hell, and God in an afterlife sort of has a stake in the game and should take these questions pretty seriously.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
All right. And
so this was a personally a strong motivator for me. And so there's a quote here from Carl Sagan that I think really captured my attitude as I approach these matters. And it goes like this. It seems to me that there is only one conceivable approach to these matters. If we have such an emotional stake in the answers, if we want badly to believe, and if it is important to know the truth, then nothing other than a committed skeptical scrutiny is required. Okay.
Right.
So this is really kind of guiding how I approached my religious beliefs and my studies of the matter.
Got it.
So now that brings us to the next slide. Slide number 7. Just says, so many billions. And you see here a pie chart. I think this chart was made in something like 2002. I don't know if the
2005,
date
I think.
2005?
Yeah.
Oh, there it is. Yeah, 2005. So it just shows a pie chart of religious denominations around the world as of 2005. So obviously the big, huge chunk of the pie, 33%, is Christianity. Then the second biggest is Islam, 21%. And then you have non-religious at 16, Hinduism, 14. There's some indigenous primal religions and Chinese traditional Buddhism, a little slice saying other. There's an itty-bitty piece like saying Judaism in there.
Right.
So something to really guide your thinking is to step back and look at this picture and ask yourself, you know, if you were just sort of born yesterday and had no idea what cultural predispositions there happened to be, and you just had this chart here and you're asked to pick a faith, you know, on what basis are you going to choose one? You know, and remember, you know, there's some serious consequences here. You can't just throw a dart at it and pick the faith that it lands on, right?
Right.
So some important consequences logically follow just by the mere existence of this chart. And the first and foremost is billions of people around the world possess absolute convictions in mutually inconsistent and incompatible ideas about God. Okay, if Christianity is true, Islam cannot be true.
Right.
Muhammad is a false prophet. But if Muhammad was a true prophet and Islam is the correct religion, then Joseph Smith is absolutely not a real prophet. So the key thing, though, is people believe this stuff.
Right.
That is, billions upon billions of people are really very hell-bent convinced in the reality of their faith.
Right.
That's a really important thing to just step back and realize.
Mm-hmm.
And that confidence does not equal correct.
Right.
Because, you know, it is a simple fact that they cannot all be right, but they certainly can all be wrong. So wrongness is kind of the default assumption we should make if we're going to look at this from a very blank slate.
Because even Christianity, of which Mormonism is just a sliver, doesn't even represent the majority. It's still a minority.
Right. Technically, it's the biggest, but it's not greater than 50%. It's only one-third of the world's religions, or one-third of the world's population representing Christianity.
Right.
So this, you know, is a point you made earlier. Whatever faith you have, or whatever lack of faith you have, you know, whatever chunk of this pie you choose to believe, you're left with this question of where did all those other pies come from?
Right.
So, you know, I'm not trying to say you should believe one of these over the other. What I'm really trying to emphasize is, where did they come from in the first place? You know, why is there this massive divide of religions? Why aren't they all converging on the one form of theology? You know, whatever you believe, you still have this issue of the fact that other believers exist. And it's not a very compelling answer to just say, well, I'm smart and I found the correct religion and they're all dummies. Or, you know, it's not very useful to say maybe that the devil is deceiving them. You know, these are not answers that explain this diversification of these religions. So this is really the question I just want to pose, and we're going to try and explore as we move along.
Right. Okay.
So this brings us now to slide number 8. Right. So you saw that big chunk of the pie was Christianity.
Yeah.
So now we have the yet another pie chart, or in this case, it looks like a lifesaver. So the lifesaver chart, the little hole in the middle. This is just Christianity alone, which again follows its own pie chart distribution. So you see Roman Catholics there make up the vast majority. But then you look very closely, you see Anglicans, you know, 80 million Anglicans, 105 million Baptists, 75 million Methodists, 87 million Lutherans, and you got Presbyterians, Reformed, Pentecostals,
right,
other Protestants, non-denominational, Eastern Orthodoxy, 230 million Eastern Orthodox Christians.
Right.
So growing up as a Mormon, you know, something that really I find humbling is we don't even register on this chart.
Of Christianity.
Yeah, this is Christianity, and we're like a subset of the other slice of the pie. You know, it's funny how, you know, Mormons like to brag about, you know, we've got, what, 13 million members, 14 million?
15, 16 now, I think.
You know, in the grand scheme of things, you know, that's nothing compared to Pentecostals. They have 10 times that number, 130 million.
Right.
So there's a certain humility that I think should be built into this fact that, you know, a central thing that defines Mormon culture is this idea of, you know, we have the one true faith, the restored gospel. You know, thank goodness for that. But, you know, you still have this issue of, you know, are you really so sure about that? Because there's 130 million Pentecostals will say otherwise.
Right.
And, you know, what makes you so confident given the fact that there's over a billion other people who seem to think otherwise?
Yeah,
you know,
we're less than 0.5% of the world's population.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So this really then begs that question, you know, what is that standard you have that makes you think you're right and everyone else is deceived or incomplete in their belief?
Right.
What criteria determines the validity or error of any particular belief we have here?
Yep.
And again, the question again that we've raised before is, how do you explain the existence of all these other Christian sects? Because, you know, there's this reference to like the great and abominable church, but, you know, that's not a particularly compelling answer of why people should feel so inclined to split into all these subsects within subsects of their particular religion. So that's a prelude now to the next slide, slide number 9.
Okay.
And I want to just do a little primer on what it means to be scientific. And so I'm going to open with a very classic experiment in physics, because it's a totally wacky, counterintuitive result, but you have to accept it just because the evidence is so overwhelmingly compelling. So I like to play a little game. So I'll say, you know, hey, John, pretend I'm a physicist
here
at MIT.
All right.
And I'm giving some discussion. I'm talking with you. And I say, did you know that, you know, time, gravity, and motion, and space are all intertwined in this one single thing called space-time?
Okay.
Is that... Do you believe that?
Sounds fuzzy, but I'm open.
That's so kind of crazy. I'm open, right?
Yeah.
maybe I'm making it up. That almost sounds like some crazy New Age talk, right?
Right.
How would you tell the difference?
Right.
If only we had some kind of tool that differentiates between real knowledge versus a bunch of made-up hokum. Okay? So this experiment is called Around the World Atomic Clocks. it was actually two papers where they made a prediction and then they measured it. And what they did, they just took cesium atomic clocks, put them in airplanes, and flew them around the world. And they actually measured a time deviation associated with that motion. That the simple fact that you pick up a clock and move around with it is enough to desynchronize it with other clocks. Or the simple fact that you move it farther away from the center of the Earth means the gravity is reduced a little bit. So then it moves a little, you know, the clock experiences time a little bit faster. You know? And it has nothing to do with the clocks and everything to do with the fact that like time itself is changing. So
that sounds crazy.
It sounds crazy, but you know, you can do this experiment yourself and you'll see the clocks deviate, and you can even compare them against Einstein's equations and they'll agree. You know, Einstein's relativity theory of relativity predicts the deviation that you would expect to find. So the take-home point here is that, you know, it's okay to believe wacky things about this intertwined notion of time and space and gravity, but that belief has a price. You know, you have to be able to demonstrate it somehow. You need a test that would differentiate between a real event versus something you're making up. So this is why evidence matters. It's the ultimate arbiter of what's right and wrong.
Got it.
So another key point is, you know, belief in such things, it's not a choice. It's a, I've heard one guy describe it, you know, my belief is not a choice. It's a matter of obligate compliance in the face of physical evidence. Okay. I don't believe this because I like it. I don't believe it's because it's simple or intuitive. I just have to believe it because it's the way things are and we have to work with it.
Okay.
So, you know, I want this to really set the tone because we're going to learn a lot of very uncomfortable things about ourselves as human beings. You know, that we're not very rational, we're not very intuitive, our memories suck, and our perceptions are extremely flawed. And we don't believe this because we like it, we believe it because we can show it. And it's something we have to deal with if we want to really understand the world.
Got it.
So hopefully that kind of sets the tone.
All right, I got it.
So now we're on slide 10. Okay. And this is a personal experience that I really want to talk about because it's a fun demonstration of social psychology in action that happened to me personally and that really motivated me to understand this phenomenon in greater detail.
Okay.
So the story begins, I am in my probably 18 or 19th year, starting at BYU as a freshman, and I took classes from the BYU Army ROTC. Reserve Officer Training Corps. Okay? And these are just future Army officers in training getting their college educations. Now, it turns out you can take their classes. They offer them as actual academic classes. And so I thought it'd be fun, and I just took them, enrolled, and you know, they gave me a nice uniform and some boots, and they taught me how to salute and how to march in formations and you know, how to assault a fixed position. All sorts of great Army stuff. How to kill people and break things. And you don't actually have to enlist. It's only if you go through the upper levels that you have to contract with them to become an actual officer. So it was a good time. I learned a lot. I thought it was really fun. But one experience in particular is very relevant to this discussion. So it's like early October-ish or so, and we're doing PT, which is physical training. Okay, it's like 5:30 in the morning, very cold out. The sun hasn't even risen. You know, you're completely exhausted because you'd rather be in bed, and you're out exercising with a group of your fellow soldiers. So after about mile four of running around Provo,
right,
you know, you're obviously very tired, you're sweaty, your head hurts, your joints are aching. It's not a very pleasant experience to put yourself through some rigorous exercise. So I remember thinking to myself, oh, God, this sucks. I wish I was home in bed. Why am I doing this? And all of a sudden, we started singing our cadences. So what a cadence is you start running in a rhythm, and you start singing these songs that are designed to keep you in a rhythm, keep you in a formation, and help you sort of pass the time. So the funny thing, though, is the things you sing about are usually revolve around how much fun you're having and how awesome you are for doing this. So you start singing about, you know, this is a great time. You know, ready now. Here we go. 1 mile. No sweat. 2 miles. Better yet. You know, hoorah. That kind of stuff. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, the irony of these songs, because I was not having a great time. And yet here I am singing about how much of a wonderful time I'm having. So I thought that was funny until I got home finally at the end of our training session. And I suddenly realized, I caught myself thinking, gee, that was really fun. I'd like to do that again.
Yeah.
And I suddenly caught myself like, wait a sec, you know, it's 5 a.m. You know, I'm totally tired. I missed so much sleep from this. I should have been, you know, could have been doing homework or something. I'm behind on some other classes. I'm tired. I'm sweaty. It was totally miserable. And yet here I am thinking, God, I wish I was doing this again. I can't wait for the next time.
Right.
So I realized, you know, another subtle effect of, you know, singing these songs as part of this group is that it's basically brainwashing. You're telling yourself that something that's intrinsically miserable is actually a good time. And, you know, to their credit, you know, physical training is good for you. You know, it's important to take care of yourself and your health, to be athletic and to be fit. And so you have a choice. You can either hate it or you can love it.
Right.
So part of the idea is to sort of push you towards loving the experience rather than hating it,
right,
so that you'll be more motivated to push yourself harder. And of course, to this day, I, you know, I'm a avid fitness freak and I exercise a lot and I love it, even though deep down there's always that part of me that would rather just go home and eat ice cream and watch TV.
Right.
So I learned a really valuable lesson that day, in that simply telling yourself something can make it true, in a sense. That is, you explain something, even though it's wrong, you just let yourself believe it and you'll come to believe it. That really struck me as, you know, a weakness on my part as a person, that it's something you should be very wary of, because it's very simple to do. The effects can happen very quickly and subtly, and if you're not careful, you can find yourself believing in something totally bogus and yet have a very strong conviction in it. So that really trained me that day to be skeptical about the world, because it's very easy to slip up. You know, you should demand evidence first and then come to your belief, but don't do it the other way around. Otherwise, that belief will transform you and bias your perception.
Yeah, it's an interesting example to use, James, because on the one hand, it's true that inherently exercise isn't enjoyable, and inherently being cold and having a headache and, and being sore is not fun. And that's true. And it's also true that there's a lot of suffering in life, and the extent to which we can, even if it's deluding ourselves, but the extent to which we can convince ourselves that it isn't so bad, uh-huh, it may be self-deception, but it also can be very adaptive in helping us pass the time. So it can be viewed as a weakness and as a strength, depending on to what ends to what ends it's used. So I just want to extend this analogy. You know, if it helped you pay for college, if it helped you fall in love with exercise, and it helped you have a positive attitude and you made some good friends, well, then that's, maybe it's a self-delusion worth making because you enjoyed it and it had a big payoff. But if you were to go on and enlist in the army and bomb, you know, bomb villages where men, women, and children were burned to a crisp, you know, then you could say that the price of that ability to convince yourself that something's okay can have a really dark side. And it depends on kind of how it's used. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm glad you brought that up. It's not that this was like a good thing or a bad thing. It was just a realization. It's something that can be used for good or can be totally contorted to use for very selfish and destructive ends.
And you could bet that Hitler's army thought he was awesome. They thought they were doing God's will. They thought that Hitler was inspired. You know, you could find all sorts of examples of people who do things that end up being bad, where the whole time, you know, just Jonestown and Guyana, where people thought they were doing God's will, but they just unfortunately were wrong.
Yeah. And of course, on the flip side, you know, if it's something that you can use to motivate yourself, if, you know, if health matters to you, you have to teach yourself to enjoy your exercise. So this is a tool you can use to help change your attitude.
Got it.
So that brings us now to slide number 11.
Okay.
Is our introduction to social psychology. So I was trained as an engineer, an electrical engineer, and this is a very hard science, okay, very rigorous, mathematically based. And So for a big chunk of my life, I had kind of a negative opinion about you poor, sloppy psychologists.
Oh. Watch it.
Yeah, we're so high and mighty. We've got math and all
sorts
of
hard big... science. We're a soft science.
And we're a hard science, yeah. And you pesky soft scientists. So I remember a big chunk of my life, I had this huge bias for psychologists for just making crap up. But then that kind of changed one day where I was at the BYU bookstore. This is about my second year as a master's student. And I was just kind of thumbing through some books, and I stumbled into the used book section. So what a lot of college campuses will do is, you know how they require books for classes, but they can't use those books forever. Eventually they have to, you know, change to a new book or update to a new edition or something. And then they're left with a bunch of used books that they can't use anymore. So normally what they do is they'll just sell them off at this huge, humongous discount. And so, for example, in this particular instance, it was 95% off.
Right. So you got, okay. you got a good, cheap textbook.
Yeah, and you know, most of the books are just a bunch of crap you're not really interested in. You know, there would be stuff like marketing or business yep. management. You know, it's probably useful if you're into that, but didn't really interest me. And somewhere in the corner, I found this book on social psychology. It's the actual one you see here is by Saul Kassin. And I kind of just thumbed through it like, social psychology, whatever. But then I read I kind of skimmed through the first chapter in the book, and it was just a huge discussion on scientific method and the importance of experiments and, justifying your conclusions with physical data and being tentative in those conclusions and willing to be wrong and all that. And that actually really, you know, impressed me. Like, wow, if they're actually devoting an entire chapter to this, it means they must be taking their science seriously. So normally this book would go for like $100. But 95% off meant it was $5.
Yeah.
So I just like, okay, sure, why not? I bought the thing. And I read the whole thing cover to cover, and I was just hooked from that day on. I had to study this stuff in great detail because it is this huge journey in self-discovery right. as you go through this. So one of the first things you learn that I said before, and I'll say it again, is people are not nearly as intuitive or rational as we like to think we are. You know, it's very common to think that we human beings are the apple of God's eye, and we are, you know, the rational creatures of this world, and we're capable of figuring out everything through logic and reason. And to some extent, we can do those things. But one thing you learn is that, by and large, we really kind of suck at it, and we don't do it very often. It's a very humbling experience to just discover how much of a complete sucker you are.
That's not a fun thought.
I'm kind of using that jokingly, but I'm being half serious at the same time. As you know, I'm going to demonstrate this through a lot of experiments of just how easy it is to tweak people's understanding and perceptions and their actions. So another thing you learn is that, you know, peer pressure is huge in the way we perceive the world and make our decisions. And you also learn that there's this idea called cognitive bias, just these weird little pitfalls that human beings have in the way we think and process information. And you got to be careful of these because they're great ways to sort of absorb information and figure stuff out. But if you're not careful, they're also very great ways to just be wrong about stuff.
Right.
Okay. Right. So the third point here is, you know, these techniques and these pitfalls, people take advantage of them and they exploit them a lot. You see it a lot, especially in like sales and marketing. We'll see some examples of that, like military recruiting and indoctrination just exploits the crap out of these techniques. You see it a lot in like political discussions and the way people form their political beliefs. And you especially see it a lot in religion. So we're going to focus a lot on that religion bullet point through our discussion, but I really want to emphasize that that's just a narrow application of the stuff you can learn from this, that it really does have this expansive application to all these other fields and interactions we have in life.
Got it.
So the fourth thing you really learn to appreciate when you study psychology is what scientific method is trying to do. And we're going to do a lot of contrasts throughout our discussion is, you know, what good science is versus bad science. And, you know, scientific method works very, very hard to neutralize these pitfalls in our thinking. So, you know, I alluded to that before with Carl Sagan, and I'm going to say it again, that a study of psychology and social psychology really gives you an appreciation for what science is trying to do and why it's very important to follow the rules of good science. And then finally, you know, hopefully this will ring with a few people, is that knowing these techniques is a great way to protect yourself against being exploited by them.
Right.
Or to teach others how to not be taken advantage of. Because if you don't understand this stuff, I guarantee sooner or later someone will come along and take advantage of these things and exploit something out of you.
And it can be a salesman or a politician, or it can be, you know, anybody.
It can be a clergyman. Yep. You know. Could be some your boss,
family, family member, whatever.
Yeah, yep. Anybody. And so it's important to realize these pitfalls, because the only way to defend yourself is to understand
how they work.
That's a key point.
Yep.
So if there's any questions, we can hop into our first experiment.
All right, so we're ready to launch in now, huh?
Yes.
All right.
And so we're on slide number 12 here, called the Ash Conformity Experiment.
All right.
And this is one of like the greatest experiments in all of social psychology, just because of, first off, how simple it is and how dramatic the results are.
Okay. All
right. So I love this experiment because it's just fun to talk about, and it's it makes you embarrassed to be a human being almost to read this experiment.
Okay.
So let's go in. It's kind of, I'm trying to be joking about this too, you know, have a good sense of humor as we study this stuff.
Sure.
So the experiment begins. You know, imagine you volunteer to take part in an experiment with some psychology professor at a university. Okay, so all you're told is that it's an experiment on, quote, visual acuity. Okay, that's all you know about it. And that's actually kind of a fun little theme that psychologists like to play, is making up some wacky name for their experiment that has actually nothing to do with the experiment itself. But it's fine. So okay, you're led into this room. They sit you down at a desk, and they present in front of you a chart. Okay, so you see here on the left this chart with three bars on it labeled A, B, and C. And they're just three lines of varying height. Okay, so you can see that right in front of you.
Yep, a small bar, a tall bar, and a medium-sized bar.
Yep, that's it. So off to the side now, they have this bar labeled bar X. And it's the same height as one of those other bars.
Okay.
And so you can look at that and see X is about the same height as C, right?
And it's pretty obvious. There's pretty much no question.
Right there. No question at all.
Yeah.
So the question for you is, which bar is the same height as the reference?
So X is the same as what? And you would say A, B, or C, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So you would say, X is the same height as C.
Right.
Okay, now to put kind of paint a picture of this, you know, you're in this little room and these charts are like 3 feet tall and barely like 6 feet away from you. So they're literally right in front of your face. I can't emphasize this enough. This is going to be important.
Okay.
So when subjects are alone, they put them in this room, they give them this test, and they go through it like 20 times and then average it over like 50 people. And all in all, they averaged about 98% accuracy.
Okay.
Right? Because it's obvious, you know, and you know, you can understand every now and then someone would maybe get one wrong, but overall it's about 100% accuracy.
Got it.
Okay, that's important. All things being equal, people are pretty perfect at this exercise.
Okay.
So now this brings us to the next slide.
Okay.
So that was the control group. So now they rearrange the experiment a little bit. It's all basically the same. They bring you into a room, they sit you down, they put the charts in front of you, only now there's six other people in the room with you. And before you get to give your answer, you have to sit and listen to six other people giving their answer.
Right. Okay. Got it.
And they rig it so you have to go last. They don't, you know, you don't know this, but they force you to listen to the other six people.
And you don't know that the other people are actually part of the experiment.
Yeah, exactly. There's a word for that. They're called confederates. A confederate is someone who's planted there as part of the experiment to mess with your head.
Okay.
Only as far as you're concerned, they're just other subjects in the experiment.
Right.
That's key.
Okay.
So they run this test 18 times, and on 12 of them, this group, they pick the wrong bar. So you can see right in front of your face, it's C, bar C, but what you hear is A.
Right, all the wrong answers.
Okay. And they're all unanimous with it.
Right.
So, you know, put yourself in this poor guy's shoes. You know, you're in this little room and you can see with your eyes what the truth is, but you have this group of six people who all just completely disagree with you. So what would you do if you were this person? You know, would you stick to your guns, or would you try risk standing out and being the maverick of the group? You know, do you want to make trouble?
Right.
You know, maybe there really is something wrong with you. Maybe they see something you don't.
Right.
Maybe your eyes, maybe you need to get your eyes checked.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
What would you do? So this brings us now to the next slide. Slide 14 just shows the results. So in a perfect world, people would get the exact same results as before.
They would still get 98% right, accuracy.
Yes.
Right.
But so here are some interesting numbers now, simply due to the fact that other people in the room give wrong answers. So first and foremost, statistically averaged over all subjects, the average conformity rate, that is people who agreed with the incorrect majority, 37%. That's almost 4 in 10 people, or 4 out of 10 trials, people will agree with the majority rather than stick to what their own two eyes are telling
even
them.
Even when it's obvious that they're giving the incorrect answer.
Yeah, you can see the charts right in front of you. So another interesting statistic. So individuals who conformed at least half of the time. Okay. So remember, they had 12 trials where they tried to mess with you. And so this means percent of people who went along with the majority at least 6 or more times out of the 12.
Right.
And the percentage is 3 out of 10 people were convinced at least half the time.
So these people are just really, really affected by social pressure.
Yeah. At least 30% of people will just trust a group rather than their own two eyes.
More often than not, go with the group no matter
yeah,
what.
Exactly.
Okay.
So a converse statistic to that is refusal to agree with any incorrect majority. These are the people who stuck to their guns no matter what. How many do you think? It was 1 out of 4 people stuck to their guns.
So 1 out of 4 will be honest no matter what,
yes,
regardless of the consequences. But the other 75% will knowingly give the wrong answer or doubt their own abilities to see and go with the incorrect majority.
At least some of the time.
Yeah.
Yes, that's the key. That is 3 out of 4 people will at one point or another cave in to peer pressure.
Yeah.
You know, and it's important to realize it's not like they're pressuring you, really. They're not like glaring at you or telling you to pick one in particular. They just raised their hand and said B and then ignored you.
Yeah. It's not super high stakes in this instance.
Yeah, it's not like they've got guns to your head or they're all pointing fingers and laughing at you or even like commenting on it. They just are
right,
taking part and giving their answer.
Got it.
So this, you know, hugely illustrates just how social pressure controls us in a very deep fundamental level.
Got it. Wow. What a study.
Yeah, I love this experiment just because it's so dramatic and in your face. So what's interesting, I got a little note here. Ash, the guy who ran the experiment, in some instances, he actually tried to vary the disparity of the lines, you know, because sometimes they could be fairly close together and you might be inclined to trust the group. But sometimes the lines are really far apart. And it's just absolutely obvious. And so he says here in one case, he made them a full 7 inches apart. Okay. So, you know, for a sign right in front of you, that's a very obvious disparity. And even then, you know, some subjects still just kept going with the majority, even when it wasn't just obvious, but like glaringly obvious. Another fun fact is he would interview subjects after the fact, and most of them, you know, would describe like this sheer terror of being like this renegade or standing out or making trouble with the group. Some subjects even like literally trusted the group over their own perception and thought there was something wrong with them. So it's interesting how, you know, people feel when you put them under this kind of pressure.
So they weren't lying. They just said, well, I must be wrong because everyone else is right. Everyone else is agreeing, so I must
them,
be wrong.
Yes.
Yeah.
A lot of them, you know, didn't really believe it. Like they could see with their eyes
right,
and they knew something was wrong, but they just had this overwhelming terror about
yeah,
standing out from the group.
Yeah.
So now we go to another experiment, slide number 15.
All
right. Some variations on this same theme is this idea of uncertainty coupled with task importance. So this is another experiment basically on the same theme of what happens if we subject people to social pressure, but then tweak some other parameters, like, you know, put them under some incentive to really get it right, or we can make it really easy or really difficult, and so on.
And again, the visuals here are going to make this study a lot easier to understand, so check out the visuals if you can.
Yeah. So this experiment, your job is to identify a culprit from a lineup. So kind of like a police lineup, right?
Right.
So what they do is they show you a picture of a guy for some fixed amount of time, and they wait a little bit for you to mull on it. And then sometime later, you're shown a lineup, and your job is just pick the culprit. And so that's pretty easy, right?
Maybe.
And they, yep. There's two conditions they placed on this, the easy and the hard. So the easy one was they showed you the culprit for 5 seconds. Which is a pretty long time to study a guy's face and memorize his features, right? So you actually see like a little cartoon of some guy. Like that's an actual screen capture from the paper. And then you see him again in the lineup. You know, he has the same face, the same mustache. Even though his clothes are a little different. But overall, you know, you can kind of recognize the guy's face. So 5 seconds is obviously a long time to, you know, study that image and try and commit it to memory. Then the hard condition, they only showed you for a half a second. So just a brief moment on, off, and that's all you get to memorize the guy's features. So they call that task difficulty. Easy, difficult, easy, hard is what we'll say.
Okay.
So the baseline is, you know, all things being equal, for the easy case, again, you know, people came in pretty accurate, 97%.
So if you can see a guy's face for 5 seconds, you can 97% of the time pick him up out of a lineup later.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. I think, you know, the lineup would be like 5 to 20 minutes after the fact, but, you know, sometime later,
okay,
subjects were able to pick them out with about 97% accuracy.
Okay.
Then the hard condition, half a second, the accuracy fell down to about 70%. So still pretty good, but, you know, you can see how it's more difficult for people to get the right answers.
All right.
Okay. So that's kind of the baseline of how people would perform. So now they also threw another curveball into this experiment. And they call it task importance. That is, they offered you a reward for doing well and getting good numbers.
Or not.
Or not, yeah. So the low importance was just simply you're doing it for science. Go through the motions and see how well you can do. Thanks a lot. The high importance was they offered you $20 if you do well.
Oh.
So now you have this incentive to really try hard and take this study seriously, right? You know, if there's $20 at stake, you know, I'm going to try and see what I can do well, right?
Right.
So they call that task importance, low versus high.
Okay.
So those are kind of the four variables in there.
So easy, hard, low importance or no money, or high importance, lots of money.
Exactly, okay. Yeah.
All right.
So now we go to the next slide.
Okay.
And this is the quirk that makes things interesting, is they do this normative influence thing again. So you're there to pick out the guy from the lineup, but before you can answer, you have to listen to two other guys give their answer first. Okay, so unbeknownst to you, they're Confederates again, and their job is to give the correct answer a few times, and then 7 out of 13 give the wrong answer. And they want to see if you conform with them or if you stick to what your memory is.
So similar to the previous experiment.
Yeah, only this time, you know, the answer isn't right in front of you. It's something, you know, in your memory that you have to think about.
All right.
They're also not trying to overwhelm you with like 6-to-1 odds. It's only two guys. So it's a little bit of a pressure, but not quite so in your face this time.
Got it.
Okay, so now we go to the results.
Okay.
This is slide 17. And so you see there's 4 bullet points on this data. You have the low importance, high importance, and then easy and hard.
Right.
So for low importance, there was actually no difference in the conformity. That is, what they're really after is how much did you conform with those two Confederates. So it turned out when they weren't offering you any money, so it's not very important whether you're right or not, people on average conformed like 2 to 3 times out of the 7.
Right, whether or not it was difficult or easy.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
That's key. You know, sometimes they were right, sometimes they're wrong, but there was a little baseline where they would tend to follow the group a little or not.
Okay.
So then what they did was they offered you $20 now. So now you're really motivated. You want to get the right answer. Okay.
Okay.
But remember now, one group, it was easy to tell the right answer. Another group, it was hard.
Right.
So you see this split in the data where...
Yeah, so all of a sudden there's a big difference because in one group... the conformity goes down and the other the conformity goes up.
Exactly. So it turns out when you raise the stakes and you make the task difficult, then people tended to go along with the group more. They conform more when they're not sure, but they're motivated to get the right answer. So if you're not quite sure, you have two other guys next to you who seem to be agreeing, well, you know, you might be inclined to trust their judgment over your own. What if you are really, really sure, and the two guys next to you, you have a very strong feeling they're wrong, and there's $20 at stake, would you be more inclined to go with your own gut or trust the other guys?
Right.
So the answer is, if it's certain and you know the answer and there's high stake, people tend to defy the group more. They'll stick to their own guns. But if it's uncertain, it's difficult, but there's money at stake, and there's two guys there who seem really sure of the answer, the default thing people will do is tend to go group more.
So if you know if money's at stake and you yeah. and you're pretty sure you're right, you're going to be less likely to conform.
Exactly.
But if there's a lot of doubt and uncertainty and the stakes are high, then you're likely to go with the peer pressure and do what people around you are doing because you're not sure and you want to be right.
Exactly. You're not sure. There's a lot at stake, and people around you seem to be sure. So you tend to go with what other people are doing.
Gotcha.
That's the key take-home point from this experiment.
Gotcha. Okay. I'm with you.
So let's go to the next slide. We're on slide 18.
Okay. Now you're going to apply it to religion. I got it. Okay. Give it to
us. So now, you know, this has some really important cultural consequences.
Describe this map for me.
So you're looking at a map here of the United States, and it shows leading church bodies. This is a data set taken in the year 2000, and you see a geographic distribution of which religious denomination dominates some geographic region of the U.S.
And there's amazingly obvious concentrations of religions, right?
Yeah. You can see like a big chunk of Texas and all of the South is this big red blob for Southern Baptism, right?
Right.
That's hugely the dominant religion in that part of the U.S.
Yep.
You look up in areas like New England, New York, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts. There it's Catholicism is the dominant religion.
Yep.
You look up at, say, the Dakotas.
And Minnesota. And
Minnesota yep. there, yeah. There it was Lutheran.
Lutheran, yeah.
And then you look over, you know, more California, Seattle, it's Catholic again. And there's this little blob here in Utah, Idaho, Arizona, that's LDS, Latter-day Saint.
Right.
So an interesting issue comes up, you know, why are there these stark cultural boundaries with religious belief?
Why such deep concentration in geographical areas, right?
Yeah, and very sharp cultural boundaries, too, you can see.
Yeah.
It's not like it's just some random mixture all over the place of colors. It's very solid regions of the U.S.
Yep.
So, you know, let's think about this in light of what we just learned from these conformity experiments. So remember, I emphasized, you know, heaven and hell are serious issues.
Yeah.
A very strong reoccurring theme among Christianities is, you know, you better pick the right faith and live the right way and have the correct morals and make the right actions, or you're going to suffer.
Yeah.
Or if you make the right actions, you're going to, you know,
yep.
be very richly rewarded.
So high stakes is like the money.
It's exactly. This is the $20 at stake, only times a billion, right?
Right. It's eternity. It's salvation. It's eternity.
Yes. Now, another interesting fact about religion is that God isn't exactly shaking your hand and dictating to you in person which faith is the correct one. You know, you might have some subtle impressions that you feel bias you towards one faith or another.
Or you may have overwhelming emotions where you're crying and, you know, you have these emotions, right?
Right. But you know, is that something that's a rigorous standard?
You still have to decide what it means. It's not clear.
Yeah.
Even though you're crying and weeping, you have to decide what that means. And it's not clear that that means do one thing or another, because people cry and get deeply emotional in every faith spectrum and even without faith. So it's
exactly,
there's uncertainty even though there's strong emotion.
Yeah, there's a lot of strong emotion, but there's a lot of uncertainty. Yeah. You know, the key thing is, you know, God isn't exactly coming down and explaining to you in person what to do. There isn't, you know, an official
right.
fact book of which religions are correct and not. We just have a lot of these competing faiths.
Like a telegram that says, you know, James, go do this and that. It's feelings that you've got to interpret. Okay. So
the third bullet point, though, is there's huge amounts of peer pressure associated with your faith. Okay. You know, even if the people around you aren't actively proselytizing you, the simple fact that they live their religion around you is enough to really pressure you. And couple into the fact that a lot of religions are extremely evangelical. They love to pressure everyone else around. They're very tight-knit and socially oriented. They love to send out missionaries and preach and try and gain converts.
Yeah.
So it's not just that social pressure exists and that people around you believe certain ways. They pressure you directly to believe.
Right.
So the simple fact
of
life
I'll just add that if you think about, if I think about the people that I know that converted to the church, or that join the church, it's sort of one of three scenarios, and this is just my experience. One is you're born into it, right? The second is that you fall in love with someone, and you want to be with them, and they're part of this religion, and so at some point you sort of miraculously get that spiritual experience that your loved one has already had. Or the third option is you come to church and fall in love with the ward community, in Mormonism's case, and you just feel such good things because these people are so wonderful. Either in any of those three cases, social pressure is extremely high. Missionaries rarely have someone just knocking on the door saying, I stumbled on a Book of Mormon, I want to get baptized, right?
And in fact, the single one of those three instances you listed, being born into it, is by far the dominant predictor of what faith you'll be. Because it basically boils down to, all things being equal, the default reaction that people are going to have under these conditions is to follow the faith of everyone around them, to conform with the group. We, by far, statistically speaking, we can't help it. Yeah. It's just part of how we are as human beings. Yeah. So, an important thing to realize, I was raised LDS, and so are you, and we live in Utah here in a very dominantly LDS culture, but if we were in Georgia right now, we'd be having this exact same discussion about baptism.
Right.
If we were in New York or Massachusetts, we would be talking about the Pope.
Yeah.
And this is something that should really,
You don't have Mormons spontaneously erupting in India or China, where like at age six they say, "Mommy, Joseph Smith," they're Hindus, right? They're Buddhists because that's where they're raised.
Yes, and this doesn't mean like people don't convert, but just by far the single greatest predictor is the people around you and what you're born into.
Yep.
So that's a really strong take-home point from these experiments.
Got it.
So next slide is called Descent, slide number 19. So this is a key take-home point that's really important to emphasize in these conformity experiments. Is imagine, those 6-to-1 odds of people unanimously disagreeing with you. What if you simply replace one of them with a fellow dissenter, someone who believes the same as you? So instead of being B, 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 A, it's B, B, A, B, B, B. Now what are you going to pick? Are you more inclined to stand up for yourself because you're not alone, or are you going to still go with the majority?
So what difference does one extra dissenter make when the peer pressure is overwhelmingly against the decision that you feel is right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So you can see a chart here where they compare, the correct responses versus the trials. So you see solo, the statistics are about like 60% accurate. Okay, so 4 out of 10 times, like we said before, people tended to fall victim to conformity.
Right.
But when you insert that ally, you see the correct responses shifts way up into like the 90s, 80s and 90s. So it takes this huge bite out of conformity to have a fellow dissenter.
Just one. And this would explain why, let's just say, Scientology or Jehovah's Witness might be so hard or hardest on those who disbelieve or leave the faith. It's because just one dissenter that you know can have a dramatic influence on whether you continue to conform against what you feel is right.
Yeah, that's a good point. Is, in any group trying to conform to some activity, you're going to have dissenters and doubters, or at least people who privately doubt. But the moment somebody starts openly vocalizing it, that is sort of the release valve to get lots of people voicing their doubts as well. Yeah. So a lot of organizations, they strive very hard to crush dissent and silence it or just get rid of it as quickly. Yeah,
what
as
does
they
the military
can.
Do if you dissent or defect? You know? Right?
Yeah.
Severe, right?
Yeah, they're very harsh in their punishment well. So this is a key idea, though, for me that motivates me to, you know, really speak out and try and get these ideas across and educate people is, you know, a lot of people might be aware of this stuff subconsciously and experiencing it and just need to have it spelled out for them by and realize, you know, they're not alone in this thinking because it'll help encourage people to stand up and express doubts as well.
Got it.
So finally, this brings us to the last slide, slide number 20, just some generic take-home points. So these are just the key points to take home, if nothing else. You know, number one, people experience very subtle yet profound behavioral pressure from social groups. Okay, peer pressure is just amazingly powerful at making us do things. So another point, conformity with false ideas can still occur even when the truth is literally sitting right in front of your face. And it always just blows me away to sit and think about that. And you know, I can often imagine, you know, if I was in that poor guy's shoes, I'd probably cave into the pressure as well. Right. So it's just makes me embarrassed to be a human being, but it's something to be realized as a fault in yourself in order to correct it and stand up to account for it. So the next point is uncertainty plus importance, or difficulty plus reward, means greater conformity. Okay, when there's something at stake and you're not sure of the answer, conformity is what people are going to do. Let's go along with the group.
Especially if there's something important at stake, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then finally, dissent is a very key principle to keeping people honest and critical rather than just falling into a herd mentality.
So we want critical dissenting people to help keep us honest, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Because you know, oftentimes people may share those doubts and they're just too shy or timid to stand up to the group. And all they need is just that one person to set an example and initiate that snowball effect, that chain reaction to get more of a group momentum going.
Got it. All right. Well, that's fascinating, James. This ends, I guess, part one of our presentation. I'll refer our listeners and our viewers to mormonstories.org to have a conversation about this presentation. And we'll continue with this presentation in the next episode. And I'll remind people to check out YouTube for the visuals or download the PowerPoints on mormonstories.org. So thanks, James.
Excellent. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. 'Tis better far for us to strive our useless cares from us to drive, to this end your hearts will swell. journeys through.